is to cooperate. Without involving the foreign doctors, they collect his blood and get ready to transfuse. They have the resources only to do a quick AIDS test. Nicole runs the risk of contracting any other disease that may be in the donor's blood. The cure may kill her. Nicole is a subject in a life-or-death experiment. Similar procedures with animals have failed in the past. The doctors ask her to sign her consent before they proceed. The transfusion is interrupted by a doctor from the Belgian Institute of Tropical Medicine. The Zairean doctors press on. That night, Dr. Masamba, head of the Zairean team, defends the transfusion at a hastily convened international meeting.
We felt compelled to try something new. There is no treatment. Tell us if there's something else we can do, and we'll do it. But we all know there's nothing. That's why we did the transfusion. We asked our nurse if she wanted us to do the procedure, and she consented in writing. As for transfusing whole blood, we simply don't have the means here to sterilize human plasma. We felt compelled to try something. Now we'll just wait and see what happens.
Everyone waits to see whether Nicole will pull through. The tension is palpable. Four days after the transfusion, there seems to be improvement.
I'm eating now. I go out. I wash myself. And I can get up without any help.
Our nurse is doing better. I'm really relieved. I think that after Nicole, other people who get sick may want us to try this same treatment. And personally, I think it will work.
A week later, Nicole is weak, but almost fully recovered. Encouraged by their success, the Zairean doctors transfuse 8 more patients. 7 survive. The Western doctors remain unconvinced.
It would not be my choice to have given these blood transfusions. On the other hand, with the pressure to do something, I can absolutely understand why these experiments were done. I think what's unfortunate from my point of view is that we'll never know whether this worked or not.
There's other possible explanations that late in the epidemic the virus may be less virulent after several passages through human hosts. There's a possibility that late in the epidemic people were having less exposure, that there was some awareness that people were being more careful, so they were getting smaller viral loads when they were getting infected. So the ideal thing would have been to have one group get the transfusions and have one group not get them or get a placebo transfusion. Unfortunately, it's not something we can study in humans. You certainly aren't going to give someone Ebola to do a trial like that. We have to wait for an epidemic situation to do that.
The transfused patients are the last in the ward. No more cases appear. The epidemic is over. 316 people had become infected with Ebola, and 244 of them had died. The international team is getting ready to leave. The samples they collected will go to various labs for analysis. They may hold the clues that will help solve the Ebola mystery.
It's a very, very difficult and critical period. We're in a transition. Everyone came to help. That's wonderful. They helped us a lot. And for that, we are very grateful to the international community. But now that the epidemic is over, we have to try to manage the crisis that caused this. And everyone is leaving.
What's wrong with you?
Huh?
All that is going back to one.
Yes.
That too.
Yes, that too, yeah.
Don't mix up with what is arriving. Never mind.
It's too bad you're leaving so soon.
It's been 18 days. I've stayed longer than anyone else.
Here in Kikwit, a hastily assembled team of Zairean and foreign scientists made medical history. In the battle against one of the world's deadliest viruses, they prevail. At least for now.
After the scientists have come and gone, after the media has come and gone, Kikwit is back to what it was before. When you have communities living in abject poverty, exposed to all the diseases are going to recur, and they'll keep on recurring, and we have to turn our attention to that. At this point, I'd put my money on the bugs.
That concludes the Ebola tape. And now we'll watch a short tape on the Gulf War syndrome, and we'll put it on the tape.
2:07 at 6.
Are Gulf War veterans and their children spreading a mysterious illness? Tonight, our new 7i team uncovers a military debate on that very question. Good evening, I'm Mike Ambridge.
And I'm Laurie Stokes. Tonight, News 7's I-Team has learned of a new twist in the debate over Gulf War syndrome, the mysterious illness thousands of veterans say they picked up while fighting in the Persian Gulf War.
Families are now coming forward to complain it may be contagious. It's an especially sensitive issue, especially in our area, where thousands of veterans live, work, and go to school. I-Team reporter Del Walters joins us now with exclusive details.
Right, Mike and Laurie, it is very sensitive. In fact, officials of the Veterans Administration say there is no such illness as Gulf War syndrome, let alone being contagious. But tell that to Senator Donald Regal, who reported 77% of the 600 veterans his staff interviewed say their spouses and children have become ill. And tell that to the veterans you're about to meet who feel so strongly something is wrong, they have approached school systems, daycare centers, and the I-Team because they think you should know how they feel. Her name is not important. But tonight, her parents believe she is the latest victim of Operation Desert Storm. They say she suffers from the same illness that may have put this man in a wheelchair and this man behind bars. That illness, Gulf War Syndrome.
I have no energy.
In March of last year, they removed my testicle.
How do you treat, you know, deep shoulder pain? How do you treat memory loss? How do you treat constant headaches?
What's the diagnosis?
Angiolipoma is a fatty tumor with blood vessels.
As they say, we're just sick and tired of being sick and tired.
What are you going to be doing in the year 2000?
I don't think I'll be here.
It is being called Saddam's revenge. Thousands of veterans have come forward to complain of dizziness, fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Some have already died. But now there is a new twist. They say what they have, you could get.
We had not visited people. We did not go to public swimming pools this year. We do not give blood. We try to take as many precautions as we possibly can. However, the military allows us to give blood. They allow us to go to school, and I can't pull my daughter out of school for a mental problem.
She has also notified her school system about her daughter. She is that little girl. She suffers from swollen glands, skin lesions, coughing, swollen stomach, and reoccurring sore throats. That same little girl who has gained no weight in 1 year. They are concerned she could pass on what they already have, and they are not alone. This family stopped running a daycare center.
And that was my main concern, was that he may have something that could affect the children, and I didn't think it was fair to bring them into that environment.
Your concern?
My concern I don't feel that our government, on the whole, is being straightforward with the public.
You know, the scientific studies that we've done have been comprehensive and intensive, and in fact have shown no evidence of a transmissible factor. I don't believe we're wrong.
Is Gulf War illness contagious, in your opinion?
Yes.
Now new voices have been added to the debate. Members of the medical community who have studied the problem and say it is time for the public to get involved.
are these questions that public health officials should be looking at?
Yes, in my opinion.
School systems?
In my opinion, yes.
Blood banks?
Yes, in my opinion.
But until that debate begins, each day this little girl continues to interact with those her parents fear she may expose. As the debate rages on between those who say what she has began here and those who say it did not. A war of words about what really happened during the war in the Gulf. Tonight, the Veterans Administration says it will soon begin testing families to see if that illness that they say does not exist is contagious. Several school systems contacted by the I-Team say so far they have seen no evidence Gulf War illness is a health concern. As for Dr. Hyman, last month Congress gave him $3.4 million to study a possible cure. Last week, Congress changed, and the Army has put his money on hold. Tomorrow, that man who went to prison and how Gulf War illness may have sent a decorated veteran to slammer. Mike and Lori?
Dale Walters with the I-Team. Thank you, Dale. I look forward to tomorrow's report.
Well, since this story is sure to prompt a lot of concern, a lot of questions, we have two numbers that you can call for help.
The first is for active military members. It's the Department of Defense Registry at 1-800-796-9699. That's 796-9699. And the second number is for anyone else. It's 1-800-827-1000. That's 1-800-827-1000. That's where you can receive information from the Veterans Administration. Well, News 7's I-Team has uncovered the shocking story tonight of a decorated veteran of the Gulf War who went to prison for apparently doing what earned him one of the Navy's top honors.
It's a bizarre case that has friends and family blaming the unknown illness many vets call Gulf War Syndrome. I-Team reporter Del Walters joins us now with the exclusive details. Del?
Yeah, Lori and Mike, the man you're about to see in a moment admits that he is either the dumbest gunrunner in the nation's history or a man who should have been hospitalized, not in prison. He went to prison for directly obeying his orders. The man you're looking at is a decorated veteran of the Gulf War. He is also an ex-con. Like thousands of other veterans, Sam Martin served in the Gulf. His mission, to capture and disarm Iraqi weapons. In doing so, he was awarded the Navy Commendation Medal. 1 year later, he was arrested by that same government for stealing the weapons he was ordered to bring back.
Somebody thinks you're a gunrunner.
Yes.
Are you?
No.
Did you ever try and sell these weapons?
No.
Did you have a person in mind to sell these weapons to?
No.
What makes Martin's case so unusual is that Martin led authorities to the weapons he was accused of stealing, packing slips and all stored in his basement. It wasn't until 6 months into his prison sentence he realized something was terribly wrong.
I just did not have the ability to fight back. I didn't have the ability to reason as far as what was going on.
When he came back, he was not himself. He was just in a different world.
Martin says he was just too tired, a condition many associate with Gulf War Syndrome.
You can't have theft if the person you're supposed to have stolen from gave it to you with permission.
Tonight, the I-Team has learned Martin may have pleaded guilty to a case that wouldn't even hold up in court.
This is not the conduct of a person who has something to hide. This is not the conduct of a person who knows that he's a thief and therefore has to hide it.
Like thousands of other vets, Sam Martin is seeking a cure and battling a bureaucracy that says Gulf War illness does not exist. For thousands of veterans, their quest for a cure has taken them from the Persian Gulf to the Gulf Coast, specifically New Orleans, Louisiana, where one doctor tonight says he has found a cure. But he is one doctor who says he is waging a one-man battle against a mystery illness and a bureaucracy that he says is the size of the U.S. government. His name is Dr. Edward Hyman. Veterans say he is the man with the cure.
I frankly think the government would be very happy if I suddenly disappeared. I guess we've had around 800 veterans call pleading for help.
How sure are you you're right?
As close to 100% as a human can get, I'm right on this. Now, whether it explains all of them, I don't know. My sampling is not that large, but of the ones I've seen, it's a cold 100%.
In the meantime, thousands wait, hoping the answers will come before it is too late. Unofficially, as many as 150,000 men, women, and children who say they are the ultimate victims of victory. The U.S. attorneys say they stand by their case, but one thing that is missing from that case this letter from Martin's superiors, saying Martin did exactly what he was told. Tonight, Martin's new orders come from doctors. He is on lithium. Mike Morse?
Is there any hard evidence that San Martin tried to sell these weapons?
No, in fact, when the investigators from the State Department showed up, knocked on his door, the investigators from the IG's office in the State Department knocked on his door, they said, "Do you have the weapons?" Martin says, "Yes, they're downstairs in my basement." Took them to him. They actually came back another occasion. He still has the packing slips and the crates that you saw in the piece with what was left behind.
Tell Walter safe.
Tonight, an update on a new 7 I-Team investigation.
This exclusive report features a happy ending. New 7's I-Team reporter Del Walters first told us about the story of a very sick girl last November. Tonight, she's recovering nicely and serves as an inspiration for thousands of Gulf War veterans and their families.
When we first introduced you to this little girl last November, she was sick. Her parents said she suffered from the same illness her father brought home from the Gulf. Gulf War syndrome.
She had, you know, lesions in her mouth. She had skin rashes. She had, you know, so much pain in her stomach. Her appetite was bad. She just wasn't feeling well.
But in 4 short months, her health has taken a dramatic turn.
The sore throats are gone. Her weight has increased. She's not coughing. She doesn't get lesions. She used to get, like, lesions on her gums. She doesn't have those. She doesn't have skin rashes. She doesn't have earaches. Her appetite's increased because her stomach isn't hurting all the time.
Both Captain Hamden and Julianne and their daughter were very sick.
Tonight, the family says this doctor represents their potential cure. They point to an experimental treatment she offers that includes high doses of antibiotics as the reason their daughter is getting better.
They've just told me they've been on the antibiotics for a month now and their daughter's gained weight. She's feeling much better.
But the government does not fund the treatment, and not all vets can afford it. Thousands of veterans have already come forward to complain of severe fatigue, dizziness, rashes, and a host of other flu-like symptoms they say they brought back from their battles in the Persian Gulf. Only now, there is a new twist. They say what they have is contagious. But the government continues to deny Gulf War illness even exists. The Veterans Administration has come forward to compensate Gulf War veterans who are sick, but to date, no specific medical treatment has been endorsed.
They finally made a cure, and they made, and she's holding a pill bottle.
Tonight, the family of this little girl says what she had is as real as the cure they think they found. Ironically, it was on Martin Luther King's birthday that she expressed her dream that others might be cured as well.
And I just want them to be cured so that people will stop dying.
For the I-Team, I'm Del Walters.
Our civilization has gone through many important changes, such as the discovery of fire, the development of the wheel, languages, religion, the Industrial Revolution, and technology. Now we are moving into a new age of mind and spirit. The next major event in history will be open contact with life forms from other worlds, taking our position in the family of man and the universe. This event has already started. But as in many historic changes, it is first known only to a few before it becomes known to the masses. The timing of this event is particularly important, since our current civilization is in the beginnings of a transformation into a state of higher consciousness that will forever change the way we live on Earth. Sightings of unidentified flying objects is nothing new. From every continent, from every major city on Earth, every week thousands of people report strange objects in the sky. In most cases, it's a one-time-only thing, or there's no camera available, or there's no eyewitnesses. Today, we're reporting on a very special situation that's going on in Miami, Florida. A man named Audrey Ng has been having contact with human beings from a small cluster of stars called the Pleiades. Actually, contact from the Pleiades is nothing new either. In 1975, a Swiss farmer named Edward Albert Meyer shocked the world when he claimed that he was having contact with extraterrestrials from this little cluster.
and he began to take hundreds of beautiful, clear daytime photos that has kept the UFO community arguing for years. And now it's happening again in Miami. Today, the story from Miami, Florida, contact from the Pleiades once again.
Miami's located on the southern coast of Florida and represents a major cross-section of the United States. If extraterrestrials were going to visit us here on Earth, mightn't they choose a place like Miami to study us? After all, here it represents major business. There are military bases to have a lookout. And, of course, there are millions of people who come here every year just for recreation. But are the ETs coming here for any of this? No, I don't think so. I think they're coming to Miami because of a man named Audriane. You see, I met Audriane about a year ago in Miami when I was there giving a lecture on my book, The Pleiadian Mission. I'd been following this contact case for years, and that had led me to Switzerland, where I spent a lot of time with Edward Billy Meyer, and wrote the book all about the philosophy of life from the Pleiades that was taught to him. After the lecture, Audriane introduced himself and told me that he'd been having contacts with the ETs for about 29 years. He then invited me to his home, and out on his patio, he proceeded to show me his photo book of all the wonderful photos that he had taken of the Pleiadian craft over the last 20-some years. A lot of the pictures were Polaroids, but it was fascinating to see that someone else had been taking pictures of these off-world crafts. He had nighttime shots, he had daytime shots. Many of the pictures, it turned out, had even been taken by his girlfriend. Audriane says that the Pleiadians normally communicate with him telepathically. First, he might get a sensation in his thoughts that they're around. Then he might hear words in his head, or he might just receive a stream of visions from them. Here in this night shot, he was driving on the freeway north of Miami. He was communicating with him telepathically, and the craft appeared right in front of the car, and he was able to get this shot. I had to ask Audriane if the Pleiadian group that he was in contact with was the same group that Billy Meyer had been in contact with. And he said, no, they were not. To his knowledge, all of the Meyer contacts were with a group of Pleiadians from a star system called Taygeta. His contacts, on the other hand, were with a different group from the star system Alcyone. To his knowledge that Meyer had ever had contact with this group, he didn't believe there was any connection at all. Here's a little drawing of what the Pleiades looks like. There are six stars, which are usually visible to our own eyes in the northern hemisphere in the winter months. The central sun of the Pleiades is called Alcyone. All of the contacts in the past with the Pleiadians have been from Taygeta. Audriane's contacts, on the other hand, are all with a group from Alcyone. He says that there are many star systems in this area that support life, and that the group from Alcyone has been coming here for many years. They maintain bases in South America. They maintain bases in the Gulf of Mexico. Sun's position on this little drawing shows you where the Earth is. The Pleiades is only 400 light years away. This next drawing here from the top shows you that the Pleiades is very close to us, just in the neighborhood. Audriane says that the Pleiadians are not here to solve our problems. They're not here to take over our planet. Actually, they mean us no harm at all. What they are here to do is to try to provide a new level of understanding and higher consciousness so that those of us who are ready can take our own individual steps through not only contacting them, but can begin to understand ways of higher consciousness that may provide a way to create a new future here on Earth that's far more peaceful. In his hometown of Miami, Audriane has begun to teach other people how to meditate, how to discover their own spiritual awareness, and how to come in contact with the Pleiadians themselves. Here in his home in Miami, Audriane has begun a mission of finding those who are ready to advance themselves spiritually and help them contact directly with the Pleiadians. He begins by teaching them meditation. It is not necessary, of course, to adhere to any mystical philosophy or belief system or religion to use meditation for your own benefit. Through meditation, you can learn to bring forth the spiritual powers of telepathy, telekinesis, and time travel. These abilities are inherent in the spirit and can be made accessible to the material self through meditation if you're willing to put in the time and effort. Even though it's popular in the East, it is rapidly gaining in use in Western society. Increasingly, more people are discovering the benefits of being able to communicate with the many different levels of consciousness through meditation. It's a method by which we gain control over our thought processes, develop spiritually, or come in communication with higher life forms such as the Pleiadians. Audriane has been teaching many people in his own meditation classes on how to shut down their material senses and come in contact with the Pleiadians. I spoke with one woman who, after just a few short sessions with him and developing the techniques that he was teaching, begin to experience the concepts of receiving visions and ideas. And pretty soon she even found a craft floating right over her home.
That day, we started, not only me, but all the people in the class started receiving, like, I don't know what to say, it's like in a state dream, receiving a lot of information.
One evening at the end of a meditation class, she asked if it might be possible to see a ship. Audrain advised her to just be patient. And on the way home that evening, to her surprise, she looked up out of the car and there was a large craft following along beside her. She believes it was a Pleiadian ship.
A lot of information over there. And the moment that we were leaving, Aida said to him, "When can we see one?" And he says, "Don't be impatient." So when we were coming back, we saw this beautiful big light. It was so near. It wasn't, you know, up there. It was very near. And we got so... For me, it was beautiful because it was the first time that I saw one. But since we are having the classes here, everybody has seen them. Flying through here.
At this point in time, Audrain thinks it's best that he keep his personal identity here on Earth private to himself. He plans on writing books, making videos, and bringing the teachings that he and the other Pleiadians feel would benefit the people here on Earth. To begin with, they want us to know that our forefathers were also their forefathers, that many times in the past, some of the Pleiadian ancestors came here and populated Earth. They are descendants of a race of people called Lyrians, who are mostly responsible for life here on Earth. Because of this, they look at us like little brothers and sisters and feel kind of a kinship for us. They are human. They are very loving, very advanced. They look just like we do. And on their world, they also have homes. They have children. They have problems with life. They have to evolve just as we do. They're not superhuman. They have to go through all the evolutionary steps just the same as we are. Audrain himself is a Pleiadian. He says that he is here by benefit is what is called the soul transfer. This is a drawing of what he looks like on a Pleiadian world. He says that he is alive 925 years in our future, our linear future right now. That years ago, back in the 50s, he is Audrain in the future, made an agreement with an Earth spirit who was not in body at the time. This was done on the astral plane. He made an agreement with this Earth spirit that when the Earth spirit came into body, that he would give that body up and let Audrain take control of it. And that's what has happened. At the age of 10, the Earth spirit gave the body up. Audrain is controlling the body here on Earth with about 10% of his soul force, and that is the life of Audrain. Audrain comes from a planet called Romul, which means the beauty of creation in their language. It's in a solar system they call Kuron, which is about one light year from the great sun body of Alcyone. The Pleiades, by the way, are in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, which is about 353 light years distance from here on Earth. Audrain says that we could think of him as a time traveler with a great task to accomplish for the people of Earth and for himself. He thinks it's a particularly important time to be here because events in our future are unfolding at a very rapid rate, and this is a most important time for the people of Earth. You see, Earth, our entire solar system, is traveling in a great orbit. It takes 25,860 years to complete. And every time we get to this particular point where we're at right now, the Earth is bombarded by fields of energy from the great central sun of our galaxy. These fields of energy have an effect on all life forms. By speeding energies up, it causes positive things to be more positive. It also causes negative things to be more negative. We were first affected by this field in 1937. Interesting that right after that, World War II started. For people who are aware of this great change that is happening and who make an effort to open their minds and raise their consciousness, it will be a great time of enlightenment and advancement. For those who refuse to recognize this, it could be a very terrible time of chaos and negativity for them. Audrine has been visiting Earth, he says, in many different time zones. In order to do this, he says he needs the permission of the Pleiadian High Council, and they have granted this so that he may travel Roman time to study us and try to be of some benefit to us. Time travel and the ability to access hyperspace, he says, are very important advancements in technology that they guard very well. These great secrets in the cosmos, they say, are very fragile, and if that knowledge should fall into the wrong hands, it could have very cataclysmic effects on things. His mission to Earth actually begins this year in 1995. He feels this mission will carry him through to the year 2000, and during this 5 years, he plans to write his books and do his teachings. Later in the future, he plans to come back at some time to see the fruits of his labors. The most important part of the information, I think, that the Pleiadians are trying to bring us is about creation itself. You see, when they examine us here on Earth, they see a planet with over 5 billion people, a little out of control. And by listening to our thinking, they can see that our biggest problems are that we do not have a good understanding about what life is. We do not understand our role in creation. We do not know very much about the purpose of our lives, why we are here. We're not even aware that there are life forms on other planets throughout the universe. It's very common, he says, that the human form exists everywhere in creation. We are all bonded together. In any contact case, sometimes some very unusual things happen, and this is no exception. The picture you're looking at, this shadow picture, happened one day behind Audrine's home. He was receiving telepathic emissions from what he thought were the Pleiadians, but when he looked out the window, there were two very large 8-foot beings in some sort of atmospheric suits behind his home. He grabbed his camera and went outside. When he approached them, and with his camera in his hand, he tried to communicate with them telepathically, but didn't receive anything. He pulled his camera up to take a photo, and as he did, the being somehow forced his hands down to the ground and made him take a picture of the shadow on the ground, as you see here. What's most interesting about this is that the shadow, in the dark areas of the shadow, the picture is quite sharp and clear, and in the very bright areas, it's blurry, which is backward by normal photographic principles, something quite unusual. He's not sure if the atmospheric suits were to protect them or to protect him. It's quite possible that the beings, whoever they were, might be carrying some sort of space virus in their suits, which could have been harmful to him. This is a picture of his original Polaroid picture that I took, that you can see here. After he finished taking the shot, he turned, the beings disappeared, and he never saw them again.
Among the more amazing technologies that the extraterrestrials seem to possess is the ability to move in time in their craft. Along with this, they seem to also have the ability to see events in time. Inside of the craft, there are screens that can lock onto any kind of energy, spiritual energy or whatever they want to do, and they can kind of fast forward, watching one event lead to another and see events unfold in the future. It's always based on probability because the future is not a fixed thing. Audrine was very concerned because he lives in Miami, which is commonly threatened by hurricanes, and wanted to know how much danger he may be in. One day aboard the craft, they decided to show him. What he saw on the screens was, in the year 1997, the hurricanes would get so bad, they would create tidal waves, which would smash against the east coast of the United States, causing terrible damage and a lot of loss of life. He's very concerned about this and wishes to warn people about it if they wish to get out of the area themselves.
This photo you're looking at is a very unusual photo. I found two or three of these in Audrine's photo album. If you look closely, you'll see that you're looking at a craft and you can see clouds through the craft. What's going on here is an effect that Audrine calls power up. When he took this picture, and he took it, by the way, with a Polaroid that has a plastic lens that operates at about 1/30th of a second, as he took the picture, the craft was powering up the field around itself, causing a dematerialization, otherwise it was going invisible. There are many accounts from witnesses of UFOs that say that they were able to see a craft and no one else could. And quite often we hear reports from someone who took a picture of craft and they can't believe that no one else around the area saw it. Here we might have some photographic evidence of how this effect actually works. We are told by Audrey Ayn that when he's inside of a craft, you can be in there, the craft, when the field is powered up, people around you right below you cannot even see you. In effect, what happens is they power the field up around the craft, it's a magnetic field, to a certain frequency that distorts reflected light, and our eyes simply cannot see it. They're bending the light waves, a simple trick apparently for them. The craft, then, in effect, could be floating right over a busy freeway or highway. They could be in the craft simply observing us. We could not see them at all. So in this unusual photo, that's what we have here. We have the field power up around the craft, and it's just in certain stages here becoming invisible, so the clouds are just slightly visible through the hull of the ship. This picture was taken on the ground. The craft appears to be probably only at 30, 40 feet, something like that, above his head when he took it. And I think there were four different shots taken here at one time. Audrine has had many opportunities to photograph their craft. Quite often they'll come and pick him up, and he will go for a ride with them. He calls it hanging out. He says because he's family, because he is a Pleiadian spirit, they treat him quite differently than they do most contactees. In this shot we're looking at here, he's in a craft, and he looked out the window and noticed there was another craft in front of him, and he grabbed his shot. If you look carefully up in the top left corner there, you can see that there's another ship. That's a large mothership. It is cylinder in shape. It was quite large. He says they flew up into that craft, and as he was hanging out with them that afternoon, and he spent some time aboard that large mothership. Now, what's most unusual about this mothership, it's a little different than we've seen before. Here I've enlarged the picture just a little bit so that you can see it. Most of the Pleiadian pictures that we've seen over the year were all taken by Billy Meyer in Switzerland. When Billy Meyer took a picture of a mothership, it looked quite different than this one. This one seems to be green, seems to have some sort of red atmospheric condition around the center of it. I don't know if that's caused by heat or whatever. And then on the front of the craft, it has some sort of white dome, sort of a dart-looking situation here. But he says the craft is quite large, several floors high, and they were able to fly right into it and spend some time there. It's very unusual to get a shot of an extraterrestrial craft in this shape. There are many pictures from all over the world of UFOs, but this one's quite uncommon. There are some other very unusual things about this picture, and if you look closely here, down at the bottom of the frame here, we have the classic Pleiadian beam ship. And if you let your eyes follow right above that, there's a white spot that appears on the picture. At first, it wasn't known exactly what this white spot was. Later, Audrey Ayn found out that this white spot we're looking at here is the projected image of an ET. He believes that one of the extraterrestrials in the beam ship there projected his own spiritual essence out into space so we could see it and take a picture of it. This was confirmed by the Pleiadians to be true and by a contactee in Puerto Rico who knew this also to be true. These Pleiadian beam ships, by the way, are 21 feet in diameter, carry three people, and are capable of interdimensional travel. Here's a closer shot of the craft, and you can see the little antenna on the top. These crafts are very common to the Pleiadians, much like our cars are to us, and this is how they navigate through space. This next craft is quite different. The Pleiadians seem to have many different types of ships that serve different functions. Most of them are man crafts that we see flying about and gets the occasional UFO photo. Not all of the crafts are manned, however. There are many remote or telemeter type ships that are around the planet all of the time. Hundreds of these are in stations around our planet for monitoring. The last three or four years, there's been a major UFO flap around the Mexico City area. Actually, from an area from Mexico City stretching southeast of Puebla, there is a large amount of sightings down there that's been going on for several years. On a recent trip down to Mexico City, I found that it was very hard to find anyone who had not seen a UFO hovering in the air at some time or another. This type of craft we're looking at right now, this Taipan-looking craft, is the type of ship that's most commonly seen down there. This is a remote ship. Some of the remotes are 3 feet in diameter. Some of them go up to about 9 feet in diameter. The larger ones, the nine-footers, do have a small seat in there, so they can be piloted if they want to. In the Mexico City area, there are many people that have taken video of this particular little remote craft down there. Audrey says the Pleiadians have quite a few of these crafts stationed down in that area. Mostly what they're doing is they're monitoring the activity of the volcano in that area. There is a very large volcano called Mount Popocatepetl outside of Puebla, which is very threatening to the people around there, and the Pleiadians are trying to warn people and try to stabilize the volcano. This next shot is a real classic in UFO photos. Down at the bottom, you can see Adrien waiting for a ship to come in. And you can see the craft up in the air there. Here he's pointing it out to me. I'm back down at his home on the patio looking through his photo book again. And he's pointing out to me that while he was waiting for the ship, there were several in the background. There may have been as many as four or five ships back in the cloud somewhere waiting while the main ship came in to pick him up. It's very unusual for us to have a photo picture of a contact person waiting to be picked up. In this particular case, the event happened in November of 1994 on Thanksgiving Day. Adrien and his girlfriend were telepathically put in touch with the Pleiadians. And Adrien says, well, it is a holiday. Why don't you come by and we'll pick us up? And they did. His girlfriend is taking the picture, and you can see him in the foreground waiting for the craft to come in. He says because it was a holiday that he thought he'd like to see his parents, and these are his Pleiadian parents in this particular craft. Another unusual thing here is that his girlfriend was allowed to take the photo. In most contactee cases, the extraterrestrials seldom let the contactees bring anyone with them, and hardly ever do they let someone else take the photos. So this is very unusual indeed. We must remember, too, that in any contact case, that generally the purpose for the photos is for belief, that the extraterrestrials allow the photos on purpose to raise our belief in their existence. By doing this, this stretches our thinking, opens our mind up to the possibility that we are not alone in the universe.